Good evening, everyone. This is Dolores Cannon with the Metaphysical Hour. And we're back live again tonight. This is August the 23rd in the year 2013. And this is my last night home. You know, I've been doing live shows all during the whole month of August. Then next week I'm going to be on the road again. But this is Bronze Live tonight. And Julia is still in England getting our office moved over there. So she's down in Glastonbury right now. So I'm on by myself tonight, except we have a wonderful guest. And she is on the line. Natalie Sudman is one of my authors that we publish with Ozark Mountain Publishing. And she has a most fantastic book and a very amazing story that we're going to be discussing tonight. Now, let me give out the toll-free number first in case anyone wants to call in and ask questions. The toll-free number is 1-888-627-6008. 888-627-6008. And I know Natalie's book is called The Application of Impossible Things. And you know, in my work, I've investigated many, many near-death experiences. I've written about many of them. But this one has several parts of it that are unusual and unique. Besides the fact that the near-death experience took place during the war in Iraq, it also has some other very interesting components that I think you've never heard before. So we're going to talk to Natalie. You're there, aren't you?
I am, yeah. Thanks for having me tonight.
Because a while ago you were a little worried you weren't going to make it back to your house in time.
Yeah, I did, yeah.
You're okay, though. You're not out of breath anyway.
No, it all worked out.
Okay, but Natalie, I always like to begin by having, you know, the guests tell about your background, you know, how, about yourself, and then, of course, I wanted you to tell the listeners how you ended up in Iraq. But first, talk about yourself.
Okay, I grew up in Minnesota, in the suburbs of Minneapolis, and I got a degree in art and Spanish from a small college in southern Minnesota, and then got my graduate degree in art from the University of Oregon in Eugene. And then I worked as an archaeologist for about 16 years. I worked for contractors and for the Bureau of Land Management, mainly. And in the early 2000s, I was working for the Bureau of Land Management, and they got a call from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers asking for volunteers to go down and help with Hurricane Katrina cleanup. And so I volunteered to do that, and I went down there twice. I went to Mississippi once, and I went to Plaquemines Parish in Louisiana another time.
It was a pretty bad hurricane.
Yes,
that was a really bad hurricane down there.
Yeah. So when I was down there,
I said you were helping with the hurricane, the damages, and
yes, I was helping. We had crews that were helping with the cleanup down there.
Okay.
Mainly cleaning up trees and a lot of that vegetation that got knocked over from the hurricane. So while I was down there, I got to be friends with some people who worked for the Corps of Engineers. And so a few months after I got back to Oregon, I was working in Eastern Oregon with the Bureau of Land Management. Somebody called me and said, "We can go work in Iraq. You want to go?" And I said, "Sure." And then I hung up the phone and went, "Whoa, what did I just say?" But I did want to. It sounded interesting to me, and I wanted to. I was curious about what was going on over there. So, in July of 2006, or maybe it was August, early August of 2006, I went to Iraq as a construction rep for the Corps of Engineers. And
that's how you ended up over there.
Yeah, that's how I ended up over there.
Okay. Now we get to the core of the subject, then. Tell what happened, how you got hurt over there.
I had been working in Iraq for about 16 months, and although a lot of civilians who worked over there never went outside the bases, outside the wire, as we said, called it, but I happened to have a lot of projects that took me outside the wire pretty frequently. And so I was traveling off base with three other Corps of Engineers people and a private security detail. And we were out for the day visiting construction projects. On our way home that day, our vehicle was hit with an improvised explosive device, a roadside bomb. And do you want me to go ahead and tell, like, the basics of what I experienced?
Yeah, we want to lay the foundation first.
Okay.
But what kind of a car were you driving in?
We were in an armored Land Cruiser. And
okay,
when we traveled off base, we would always go in an armed convoy. We had personal security detail for our guards. So that day we had four vehicles. The first vehicle was guards in their armored Land Cruiser. We were there was another vehicle in front of us that had two other Corps of Engineers employees and two guards, and then our truck was third, and then we had a fourth truck, or what we call a gun truck, with three guards in that truck.
And so to go ahead and tell what happened then, when you said it was a roadside bomb that went off then.
Yeah. When the bomb went off, I had been sort of half asleep, my head propped on the windowsill, and all I remember is I don't remember the blast. I didn't hear it. I left my body before that happened, and all I heard was a pop, like just that, even that quiet. And I remembered. I had flashes of memory of where I had just been, out of body. But at the time, you know, I knew that we had been blown up, and even though my eyes were closed, I knew that it was bad. So I just kind of put those things out of my mind to deal with the physical world that I knew was had to be dealt with.
Well, I remember in the book you said it was later. I'm just going to skip ahead a little bit, and then we're going to go back. You said it was later when you were in the hospital that a lot of these memories began coming back, and you wanted to write them down before you forgot them. Isn't that true?
Well, yeah. That's kind of two things. I knew that something had happened. I knew that, you know, I had been out of my body, and I had just little kind of pieces of memory that remained of that time. But as time went on in the hospital, I remembered more and more of that. But I also, it seemed really, really important to me to go over and over my memory of the physical world event so that I remembered what I thought and what happened. Because it's very easy to start to shift and change your memories. And I don't know why, but it seemed very, very important to me to not do that, to not turn it into fiction, but to remember as clearly as I could
yeah.
the sequence of events and what had happened. So I spent a lot of time going over the physical world events, and it took a little while before I finally went, oh, wait, you know, I've got these other memories. And then as soon as I started paying attention to those, it's like all that memory of where I had been out of my body came back very clearly.
Okay. All right. Well, then now let's go back to when you went out of the body and tell what happened then.
I call it blinking out of my body, because I was in my body and then I was not. It's that quick. And I was standing on kind of a circular oval stage, and there were all these, I'll just call them people, beings, whatever, personalities, all arrayed all around me. It's thousands of them. And I was downloading information to them. I was, you know, I could say telepathically, but it was even shorter than that. I mean, it was sort of conceptually giving them information. And they were sending me gratitude for doing that. And I when I had finished with that, I told them that I wasn't going to go back to the body, that I was done. I didn't have any interest in coming back to the physical world. And they immediately suggested that they would like to have me come back if I was willing to do certain things for them.
They had a criteria then.
Well, I wouldn't say that it was a criteria. It was more like an offer. Like, well, would you like to go back? You know, we need this work done. Would you like to do it? And if I didn't want to do it, I could have said no. But just like the way I said yes to going to Iraq in the first place, maybe. You know,
so, for the moment.
They offered me something that sounded interesting to me, and I said, oh, okay, sure, I'll go.
It is like with Iraq, letting you say, what was I thinking of?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I remember in the book said that you could see your body. Well, go ahead and talk about the offer, and then I'll stop interfering. You go ahead and tell it your way you want to do it, step by step.
That's all right. I could see my body from that place. I wasn't paying any attention. I had absolutely no interest in the physical world or my physical body at that point when I was talking to all these beings. But after I had finished downloading all this information to them, and they had made me this offer, like, would you like to go back and do this? Oh, yeah. Then I blinked to another place. And I call this the deep rest environment, because it was almost more like folding into myself very deeply, into this very private, infinite, peaceful space. And in that space, I rested and recuperated. And this is where I would describe myself as having what some people call a life review. But it was more like just kind of floating through memories, kind of like, you know, on a lazy summer afternoon, you might start thinking about, oh, remember when I was a kid and did this? It was that easy. There was no judgment to it, and there was no picking through things and this was good, that was bad. There was none of that. It was just sort of a drift through memories.
Okay.
While I was in that space.
Uh-huh.
And then when I was finished there, and I couldn't tell you how, you know, there was no time in that space, so I couldn't say how long I was there. I was there as long as I needed to be. And then I blinked back again to the big gathering of personalities. And we kind of exchanged some more information. And then I blinked again, and I was in an environment that I call the healing environment. And that's where I could see my body, down in the truck.
The healing environment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of like I was, I had an aerial view of the whole scene. The truck below me, the blown up truck, the other truck, the highway and the desert. But I was just focused on my body. I could see into the truck. I could see my body. And I was with, in this environment, I was with two other people, being whatever you want to call them. One was a very good friend, and the other was sort of, it seemed like this other being was sort of like a trainee. Because me and my friend were having, we were having a lot of fun, honestly. We were choosing my injuries. So it would be like waving a hand and part of my brain would be blown out, you know. And then we could, as soon as we did that, we could see a trajectory of the future, of how I would handle that in this lifetime. And we just thought that was hilarious, you know. Oh, wow, look at this. So then we'd, you know, just wave a hand and change it. So, okay, now I'm missing my foot or something. And we would see that trajectory and how that looks like in a future life. And we fooled around like this for a long time. It was very, very amusing to us from that point of view. And eventually we said, okay, you know, quit fooling around. We got to just do this. And so, you know, poof, I made the injuries that I have. And those injuries were chosen for specific reasons in order to place myself.
You really
well
should have
for
died.
The things that I had agreed to.
But then, isn't that true? Your injuries were so extensive.
Yeah, the injuries that I first saw when I looked down on my body were very extensive. Yeah, part of my head was missing. I had a huge hole in my side. My hand was. I don't know. I think my right foot was blown off, and my hand was in really bad shape. Yeah, it was not a body that. I mean, my brain wouldn't have worked.
You really died right there then.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, as far as I know. Yeah.
Okay, then, and tell us what happened then.
From there I moved, it's like I said goodbye to these two beings that I was with, and then it was kind of like moving right down into the scene, but everything was static. It was, I describe it as standing between time. So I was in the scene, but nothing was active or moving. And then I just slipped back into my body from there.
Uh-huh. But I was remembering from the book, didn't you say that the beings helped to reverse the injuries of the body and help put the body back together, didn't they?
Well, this friend that I was with on that sort of aerial view, in what I call the healing environment, this being and I did that together, the two of us.
Uh-huh.
Did that. We healed that body. Well, we healed it. I mean, that's kind of a funny word for me to use, because it was more like we just changed it.
Changed
we didn't
it.
Necessarily, you know, we had the capacity and the skill or whatever to give this body any injuries or no injuries, but we chose very specific injuries. And then created those in the body.
Well, like you said,
so
that half of the head was blown. You said half of the head was blown off, and the foot was missing. Did you put all that back together?
Well,
I'm remembering the book
back together
because
makes
I did the book. Okay.
Yeah, putting it back together makes it sound like we were sort of building it back or something. But it's not the way I perceived it. It's more like the physical body was just an organization of energy. And so all we did was reorganize the energy. And by reorganizing the energy, you reorganize the manifestation of that.
That's a good way to put it. I'd never thought of that wording. Mm-hmm. Yeah, to reorganize the energy then.
Yeah. So that makes more sense to me than saying that we healed anything. We didn't heal anything. We just reorganized the energy.
Rearranged everything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because the part, like on the head that was blown away, all of that was reorganized back the way it should have been, or the way it was?
Well, not entirely. I still have a hole in my head, which has been great for jokes, but it was a very small hole in my head.
Yeah, I want to make sure the listeners can follow this, that's why. Okay.
Yeah.
Because to me, it's quite amazing that this could happen. I've never heard of this in any other near-death experiences that I've investigated, actually putting the body, rearranging the energy.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it's possible, but I just want to get your viewpoint.
Yeah, and it was very easy from where I was. I mean, it didn't... During this whole time that I was out of body, I never thought any of this was strange. It was all very natural to me, and it was all very easy. It was effortless to do that rearranging of the body.
That's why you said it was like having fun. You were joking about it because it mm-hmm. wasn't that hard to do.
No, it wasn't. And also from that point of view, you know, from our physical world, physical mind, point of view, those injuries, I mean, some of those injuries that we were playing with they would have been very, very difficult to manage and to, you know, live another 40 years within. And so I don't want anyone to think that that we were laughing at, you know, ha-ha, you could be really hurt badly. We weren't laughing about that. We had a totally different point of view. We were outside, entirely outside the physical world. And even though we were aware that this would feel like, you know, these injuries would feel painful and could potentially be difficult to deal with, from our point of view, outside the physical, we understood that those injuries, number one, had purpose. They had value, very specific purpose and value, and that they had no, they could not hurt who I really was, which was energy. I mean, you can't destroy energy. So the consciousness that I am is having an experience in this body. But I'm not this body, and that's the awareness that we were moving from and that we were playing from.
Mhm. Yeah, I can understand all this because my husband went through a similar experience, but that was 45 years ago, and I didn't know anything about any of this. And it was only after I got into this work that it began to make sense to me. And mm-hmm. so what you're saying, I can identify with. But
I think a lot of people have trouble getting outside that physical mind perspective. And I totally understand that. I sometimes still have trouble getting outside of it. I have to just tell myself, well, you know, right now I can't get to that other perspective, but I've been there, and I know it's real, and I'll just, you know, soldier on. But sometimes it takes some faith.
That's the human mind. The human mind is the part that it's unable to handle the concept.
Yeah.
But, that's what I've been told in my work.
Our whole self or talking over me?
I keep talking over you. Yeah, sorry, I don't
think
mean
it's
to.
Both of us.
Yeah, But that's what I've been told in my work. It's not the brain, it's the human mind that has no concepts at all, has no way of understanding all of this, because it's the way the human mind is set up. So yeah, when you're out of the body and you're away from that physical, it all makes perfect sense. But then try to explain it when you come back in.
Yeah, it can be difficult. I've explained this at times by using an analogy. If imagine that a little child, like a little girl, falls down and scrapes her knee, and she comes to you just bawling and screaming and crying. Well, she's hurt herself, you know, and she thinks it's a huge deal. But yeah. You as an adult, you see that little scratch on her knee, and, you know, you give it a kiss and you say it'll be fine, you know, and you send her on her way. Because you know it's not as bad as she thinks it is. And that's kind of how it was from that other perspective. When you can see a broader viewpoint and understand who you really are as a consciousness, as a being, as a soul, whatever word you want to use, then your perspective is very, very different. And you understand that even though at this moment you may be in excruciating pain or things may be very, very difficult, you, the real you, is whole and complete and perfect all the time.
You can never harm that part.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. But what would you say, the foot was blown off? Did they rearrange the energy to replace the foot? Or I'm just curious.
Well, it's almost like imagine that you're looking at someone, but all you're seeing is an energy organization. So even though that foot is separated from the leg, it is still energetically connected to that leg. And so all you're doing is rearranging that energy again so that the foot, the manifestation, the physical manifestation of that foot appears to be reattached to the leg. But all it really is energy. So all you're doing is reorganizing the energy.
Uh-huh.
And I have no idea what that would have looked like from the physical world point of view. I have no idea what that would have looked like. If it even, I mean, I could have been doing this between time, so that it could be that that someone actually seeing that wouldn't even have seen anything.
Yeah. Like it was happening outside of time.
Yeah,
but a thought just went through my mind, too. This goes along with what the doctors call the phantom limb syndrome, you know, whenever, if they have to amputate, the body still believes it's there.
Yeah.
And you've heard of that one.
Yeah.
So I think it goes along with that. The memory is still there.
Yes, because the energy body, I mean, there's different levels and different ways to talk about this, but there is also, besides the physical manifestation, there's an energy body, at least in my experience. There's an energy body, and that energy body, even though you may lose a foot or you may lose a finger or something physically, that energy body is still whole.
Yeah, I believe that.
But that also, that whole phantom limb thing, that's kind of more complicated, but because it gets into actual mechanics of the physical body and the way the nervous system is wired, it's more a mechanical thing too.
Okay, I just thought, you know, it was a memory. The body was still remembering that it was there anyway. But now, I mean, you do, the foot is there. You have the foot.
Yeah.
But you said they did leave some physical things. They didn't repair everything.
No. I had a broken heel and both the bones in my forearm were completely shattered, and the wrist was broken, and I had a lot of shrapnel in that hand, and I had all the bones on the right hand side of my face were broken. I had a hole in my skull between my eyebrows, and my right eye had shrapnel in it, but it also, the retina was pretty much just in tatters. And when the swelling went down, the retina detached. So they did reattach the little, you know, what was left of the retina. But there was also muscle damage in that eye, so that eye doesn't line up with the other eye, and I don't really see out of it well.
Okay. Well, I remember in the book you said that when you were working with the beings to do this, they decided to leave you with some physical defects or problems for a reason.
Well, they didn't decide. I decided.
You decided. Okay. Why did you decide to have some physical problems when they were working on it? You know, to remain.
Because those physical, I don't want to use the word problems, because they aren't problems to me. And they're not problems. I understand that other people perceive them that way. I chose those injuries because those injuries would serve my purposes.
Down the road,
they would position me in a place that would serve my whole self wants to do in the rest of this lifetime.
Like your mission, your purpose, you mean?
Yeah, it had to do with what I agreed to do for that that gathering of. That big gathering of beings, and also what I was interested in personally, because I know people use the word mission or I don't like that word mission, because it's, to me, it has connotations that don't really fit. I agreed to do something. And I can choose not to do them at any point in time. Right now, I could say, well, you know, that seems like a good idea then, but no, I'm not going to do that. That would be fine. I can do that.
You have free will.
So, yeah. So I call it an agreement. I made an agreement with them. I said, sure, I'll do that for you. And then I also, you know, have my own interest that I'm pursuing, sort of within that or beside it or whatever you want to, however you want to say that.
So that was the reason of keeping some of the physical challenges, I guess you would say, instead of just healing. You're using the word healing again. I mean, it's the English language. What are we going to do with semantics?
Yeah.
But, you know, to leave some... Because it definitely had a reason.
Yeah.
Because in my therapy work, I work a lot with people with physical problems, and I tell them there's always a reason for everything.
Yeah.
And it's all lessons, really, to see what they can learn from the situation.
Yeah, and they're very valuable lessons. You know, we think of lessons... Again, lessons, you know, we think of school and you're going to get graded and you have to do it right, but that's not really what it's about. It's about gathering experience, gathering wisdom, and gaining knowledge and wisdom.
What do you learn from the experience?
Yeah, what do you learn? What's of value to you that you can apply in many different ways? You know, it deepens your beingness. It makes you richer for whatever, even though, I mean, I totally understand that a lot of times that just seems impossible to people. You know, they're in miserable situations, so that, you know, their lives are very, very difficult. I can only say I know how that feels, but I also know that there is a very valuable reason for that.
Yeah.
It does
happen. But see, I deal with this all the time, so to me it doesn't seem impossible. But, you know, I can understand other people's viewpoints, too.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, my husband, he was in the Navy, but his body was crushed, and he really died three times because he lost all the blood in his body, brain concussions, and he was crushed from the waist down. But when they got him to the hospital, they said there was no way he could live. There was too much trauma. And that even if he did live, he'd be a vegetable. It was all that. I wrote about this in one of my first books. But I kept telling him, no, he wasn't going to die. But it was amazing was, you know, the doctor said, well, I guess if you believe that strongly, maybe he'll be okay. He was in a, I don't want to say coma, he was just unconscious for days. But when he was in the hospital, though, even a day or two later, they weren't even going to do anything because they saw Cherry was going to die. His body began to go back together by itself.
Yeah.
And they were calling him the Miracle Man. They couldn't understand it because his face was torn apart, and they thought they were going to have to do plastic surgery. And they watched as it all went back, and he didn't have to have any surgery. And then his legs, everything began to mend itself to a certain degree.
Yeah.
Then they decided, well, okay, we'll start working on him. But I didn't, back then, 45 years ago, I didn't understand a lot of this. This is what started me on my journey. But now I know more about the body being energy. And I probably, what happened that night was he was meeting with the beings on the other side and saying, are you really sure you want to go back and do this, or you can stay over here? This is going to be very difficult.
So yeah, that's entirely possible.
It makes perfect sense, because he ended up in a wheelchair for 25 years. But I know there was always a reason, we knew that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that makes sense. If the body can reorganize itself and repair itself.
Yeah, what I've really, from my experience, the body, if we can get our minds out of the way, all our beliefs that say that we need doctors and we need this and we need that, if we can get those beliefs out of the way and let the body do what's natural to it, it will start to heal itself. But, you know, that sounds so simple, and it's not simple, because our beliefs are very deeply rooted, and a lot of them are unconscious. So, you know, sometimes it may have been that, you know, your husband being unconscious was the perfect, sort of the perfect place for him to be at that time. Not only, you know, certainly he and some beings could have been working on his body, but then too, he may have been off doing something else, and the body left to itself began to heal itself too.
But it wasn't time for him to. But see, that's what I do in my work, and I'm teaching this all over the world, that the body can heal itself. And I'm always telling that, you know, that the body is a miraculous machine. It's been created to heal itself and take care of itself if we don't interfere.
Yeah.
But I think what you experienced was just, it's so remarkable. But you could have died that night, but you had work to do.
Yes, I did.
But, see, was there were other people in the car with you, weren't they?
Yes, there were. There were three other people there. The guard that was sitting in front of me was killed, and the driver and my colleague and I were all severely injured.
Uh-huh. That's what I was thinking. If, you know, people coming back from Iraq now, they're having many of these experiences, you know, where they've there's so many roadside bombs and so many head injuries, and there's probably many of these people had these near-death experiences, but they can't talk about them. Nobody would believe them.
Yeah, I have no idea how many people have them or remember them. I don't really know. I've read a few soldiers who have from Vietnam era who have talked about their near-death experiences. Yeah. A lot of these soldiers are very young, and this kind of an experience, you know, if they have something like this, like you said, there's not really a place for them to talk about it, probably.
I know.
The military.
But finally,
I'm
finding out now, I'm lecturing all over the world, that people are waking up and they're beginning to understand these things more, where they're making more sense. We're thinking outside of the box, I guess you would say, so that it's no longer so cut and dried. Miracles are possible, and they are happening. That's why we understand this. We can control our bodies. We can heal our bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Once we understand the power of our mind, anyway.
Yeah, I think as more and more people talk about these things, you know, travel around the world like you do and actually talk about them to all kinds of people, then I think the ideas get to be so they don't sound so strange. And people realize that, oh my gosh, you know, if even 25% of the population is having experiences like this, then mm-hmm. maybe there's something here. You know,
yeah.
Maybe it's not just a bunch of hullabaloo. Maybe we ought to actually look at this.
If some of my clients will be sitting there talking to me and they'll say, I'm going to tell you something I've never told anyone in my life. And they
yeah.
begin telling stories. And they're looking at me like, you mean this is not shaking you up? And I said, no, I've heard it before.
Yeah.
And it's the first time they've been able to really talk about it.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thing. I love it when people start out saying that. Because it's good.
I said, don't worry about me. I've heard it all. Nothing you say is going to shock me.
Yeah, and it's I think, I mean, from my experience, it's such a revelation for those people to understand that they're not the only people out there who have had these experiences, and they're not crazy.
Yeah, that's why they're afraid to tell anyone, because they're afraid that people will think they're crazy.
Yeah.
But no, it is becoming more and more common knowledge, you know, that we're not afraid to talk about psychic phenomena and things that are
mm-hmm.
happening. That's why I think your book is so valuable, because it does give, especially these veterans coming back, it shows them that these things do happen, so they don't have to be afraid to talk about it. That's why I think
it's very valuable.
I
would hope that. Thank you. I would hope that it would get into the hands of a few vets and be helpful. I don't know. I guess maybe I'll find out. I have had a couple of vets contact me and tell me that they did have their own near-death experience, but that they would never say anything publicly about it.
Yeah. There's probably a lot more than we even know
mm-hmm.
at all.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, PMH Atwater has made a lifelong career of studying the near-death experiences, and she's written several books about it. So she knows there's a lot more going on out there than people think of, that they realize or understand.
Yeah, she has written some really good books about this, you know.
Yeah.
And
Natalie, the government gave you the Defense of Freedom Medal, and after all this happened. And you and your friend, it was Jared Bonnick, because he was also in the roadside attack too, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
Uh-huh. And they said the Defense of Freedom Medal is the equivalent of the Purple Heart, but it's given for civilian people who were hurt in the wars.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, I was honestly kind of uncomfortable with getting a medal for that, because it felt like there were a lot of people that I worked with in Iraq who were much better at their jobs than I was. They were much more skilled. They had been there longer. And I felt like, and all those men who were our guards, you know, we hear a lot of bad things about the personal security details after some of the scandals in Iraq with one of the companies. But the men that I worked for were very, very professional. And they, you know, it was mind-boggling to me that they would go over into a war zone and act as my guards. I mean, put their lives in front of mine for money. I mean, what's money? It sort of blew me away. And so I felt
money
like
is just energy. We're learning everything is energy.
Yeah. Well, I felt like that medal should have gone to those people, not to me. I mean, I was just kind of, you know, in one sense, in the physical world sense, I was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. In the energy sense, I was in the right place at the right time. But the medal, I feel like I just pulled that, like I'm sort of a caretaker for it. But it belongs to everybody who was over there.
Yeah, I understand that. But, you know, it's the same way with the Purple Heart. You know, they give it to people who are injured in the wars, and
mm-hmm.
a lot of them say, you know, why did they give it to me?
Yeah,
it's the same idea, you know.
I totally understand that, yeah.
Hmm. But anyway, how long were you in the hospital?
I was an inpatient at Walter Reed for about a month. I got out 2 days before, 2 days? 3 days before Christmas. And then I was an outpatient for another about 2 years.
Well, they were, you did therapy and everything?
Yeah, I did occupational therapy, physical therapy, and I had some other, you know, minor surgeries here and there from my eye and on my wrist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I've been aware of that. My husband was in hospital for a year, 8 months in a body cast.
Oh, wow.
I've often wondered, what would that be like to not be able to move for 8 months, you know? So,
yeah.
It makes you wonder, was it worth it coming back, you know, to this life?
Well, I know from my experience, I spent a lot of time, the first week or two in Walter Reed, I spent a lot of time out of my body. I mean, I was just sleeping or sort of drifting.
And
it didn't really matter to me where I was, or it was actually really a relief to be able to just lie there and let somebody else take care of me. I was so tired. Working in Iraq, I worked 7 days a week, and we worked long hours. And so I was really kind of exhausted. It was actually kind of nice to just lie there on the hospital bed.
Yeah.
I thought, am I finally getting enough sleep?
Now you're okay, aren't you?
Yeah.
But anyway, you've gone on with your life, and what are you doing now?
Well, I'm still writing. I haven't gotten anything put together in a final form of a book, but I do have some fiction that a small press in Minnesota is interested in publishing, and that I wrote like 20 years ago. And I write on my blog a little bit, and I'm an artist, so I do paintings and ceramics, and I do psychic readings for people. And I'm also working with a friend of mine, a couple of friends of mine. We're putting together some programs for vets and people with PTSD, using sound technology that the Monroe Institute in Virginia, they pioneered that binaural beat technology and the sound technology.
Mm. So anyway, you're back here for a reason, and if you don't know it now, it'll become clearer as it goes along. Maybe one reason was to get the book published.
Well, I think that was one reason, yeah. So thank you for being a part of that.
I've told on her before, I get hundreds of manuscripts. I have to read them all, and then majority of them just go back. And I know when something is good, it's got a story to tell. So I'm the one that decides. Okay. Well, we're coming close to time. We're going to have to sign off. But, Natalie, if anybody wants to get a hold of you, if they want to contact you, is there any way they can do it?
Yeah, they can email me at njsudman, S-U-D-M-A-N, at gmail.com. And I have a website, www.nataliesudman.com, and there's information on that website about my artwork, my writing, and the psychic readings. And my blog is www.traceofelements.wordpress.com, so they can get in touch with me through any of those ways.
Okay. That all sounds good, because a lot of times they do want to contact our authors and the ones that are guests on the show. I want to thank you for coming on tonight. It's a fantastic story.
Thank you, Doris. Thank you for inviting me.
And I admire you in putting it down on paper so that it can get to people. I admire you for doing that.
Thank you. It was fun, actually.
Okay, well, it's about time for us to sign off now, so I want to thank you for coming on the show tonight. And thanks, everyone, for listening. And have a good evening. Good night, everybody.